The Financial Survival Network, helping you survive and thrive in the new economy. Go to carrielutz.com and sign up for 30 free micro trainings on financial survival.
Great news, we've got a sponsor. This show is now brought to you by Miles Franklin. And when it comes to protecting your wealth, you know there's nothing better than gold and silver. That's what I'm buying. I hope you're doing the same. And once you make the decision to buy gold and silver, there's no better place than Miles Franklin. Look, they've been in business 22 years. And the reason I'm a customer is because when you buy, they ship. Go to milesfranklin.com or call them at 800-822-8080 to get a free quote. $14.90 WGCH. This is Kerry Lutz. You're listening to the Financial Survival Network. If you've been worrying about metal prices, watching the action, seeing gold and silver get knocked down, go up again, and get knocked down again, then you might want to start thinking about metals ratios. It's a way to figure out values relative to one another, and it can really help bring an added perspective. And with me now to discuss it is the mercenary geologist, Mickey Fulp. Mickey, you there?
I am, Kerry.
Hey, well, welcome back. And as always, it's a pleasure. So what are the metals markets telling you these days?
Well, they're telling me that, as we had predicted, that platinum is on the rise. And we first talked about this in October, commented about the fact that the platinum to gold ratio was skewed very heavily toward gold, less than one, and that's quite unusual. And we at that time predicted that wasn't going to last very long, and it did not last very long. We now have platinum at 1676 today as we speak, and gold is 1658. So the concept of metal ratios is quite interesting. It's a simple concept. Take one metal price and divide it by the other metal price. But I first started using this not in evaluating commodities and not really in economics, but as an economic geologist doing exploration. And in the late 80s, when I was working as a consultant for the giant copper company Kennecott, now a piece of Rio Tinto, we use metal ratios in searching for porphyry copper deposits with simple concepts of one metal is more mobile than the other. So we were looking for buried porphyry coppers, and we found that we could use the copper molybdenum ratio to find supergene enriched copper blankets, which tend to be the highest grade and the best deposits in the world. And that basically happens because copper is very mobile in the Earth's rocks and soils, so it moved around by groundwater, whereas molybdenum is insoluble and it remains. So we could search for leached caps where the copper has been removed and deposited deeper down by looking for high molybdenum values. So it's a relatively simple extrapolation for me to now apply that to commodities markets.
So I'm an average investor. How do I figure this out?
Well, you look at charts. So go and look at 5 and 10 year charts of metals and then sit there, and it's not such a great task to compile prices and then compile ratio charts. We do that all the time in my business, and see what's out of whack. So we knew platinum gold was out of whack, and it gave us a buy signal on platinum back in October, and I purchased some platinum at $1,500 an ounce, which we've talked about before, and on paper I have quite a good return. Right now, the platinum-palladium ratio, I think, is still out of whack. It's still too low. Historically, it ranges between 3 and 4. It's still stuck in the range of 2.3 to 2.4. I think that's because of rumors of depleted Russian stockpiles, which very much may be true. So you might want to tread cautiously with that idea. Gold and silver right now is 51. That's pretty average post-crash when the gold to silver ratio at one point got to, I think, 84. It's been as low as perhaps 39 or 40, but I'm comfortable with 51. Mm-hmm. The real ratio that sticks out like a sore thumb right now, and we're going to switch to energy, would be oil to gas. Oil to gas ratio is gone exponential. It has to go parabolic at some point. It's with a WTI price this morning of 106, a Henry Hub price of 207. We're talking 51. And yeah, that's all I could say. You know, I wrote a few notes before we talked, and all I put was wow, exclamation point.
Yeah. So, and it should be like, if you're going energy wise, then a barrel of oil, it should be 6 to 1 to right, 1,000 cubic feet.
That's right. So actually, in that regard, so we switch from 1,000 cubic feet to millions of BTUs essentially it's the same. 1,000 cubic feet of gas is about 1.07 or 1.09 million BTUs, depending on the purity of the gas. So for all practical purposes, it's the same. But yeah, wow.
And a barrel of oil is 6 million BTUs, right? Give or take.
I guess it is. Yeah. So more or less. Actually, I think it's 5.6 on average. But the IRS uses 6 as its barrel oil equivalent ratio for tax purposes. So the USGS uses 5.8, but for all practical purposes, we'll just round that up to 6.
That's a rather remarkable disproportionate ratio there. I mean, we're looking, it reminds me of sugar. I guess it was back in the 80s and 90s when it was, they thought they were just going to have to give it away because it was like under 2 cents a pound. And you have commodities that can have this undervaluation and it just goes on for a decade or more until it stops. But eventually it stops, right?
Well, it's got to come back to the norm at some point. You know, this stuff all acts like bell-shaped curves, so we get outliers on one side or the other, but the world functions statistically as a bell-shaped curve. Also of interest, I think, right now would be the price of gas in Europe, which it's wildly fluctuates from one country to the other. A lot of it has to do with the fact that most of it is supplied by Russia or crosses territories controlled by Russia. But that average is probably $10, and I'm talking dollars, not euros, $10 per million BTUs right now. So the oil and in this case, we would use the Brent price, and we've got this great arbitrage going on right now between Brent oil at 126 a barrel and WTI at 106. So let's use the Brent price of 126 and the current average price of gas in Europe of about $10 per million BTUs. So that gives us an oil and gas ratio in Europe of about 12-5.
Which isn't so bad.
In Asia, where gas is used extensively and LNG is used extensively, especially in undeveloped countries. I mean, you go to Peru or even Mexico, and you go in and you buy, you fill your tank from LNG compressed gas. So in Asia right now, it's about $15 per million BTU. But in North America, gas is a landlocked commodity. Until that changes, I see no hope for the natural gas industry.
Yeah, till there's pipelines and and liquefaction facilities. Now, something I read about, and I don't know if you caught this, in China, they appeared to have a large area similar to like the Eagle Ford shale and the Marcellus shale, where they thought they were going to have zillions of BTUs of natural gas. And as it turned out, that shale is different, much harder to reach. We don't have the technology to extract natural gas from that potential Chinese gas field there, which hasn't exactly, that finding hasn't exactly been widespread. Did you happen to catch that?
No, I hadn't caught that, but each reservoir, and bear in mind that what we used to call source rocks, the shales, the organic rich shales, are now being exploited as reservoir rocks. But until you get into these things and you drill them, and you drill them horizontally and you frack them with latest technologies, you don't quite know what's going to be there. You don't know exactly how tight or permeable they will be. This shale oil, shale gas phenomena that we are seeing in the United States, and it's really moved more to shale oil with the Eagle Ford and the Bakken as the premier reservoirs right now. The technology that's being employed is pure, good old American technology and ingenuity, and it has not very much gone beyond our borders. So the potential for shale oil and shale gas in other parts of the world are tremendous. In the United States, we have been forced to do this because we have exploited our best oil and gas reservoirs for up to 100 years now.
Yeah.
And so peak oil is a legitimate concept, but only in the regard that peak oil occurs in oil fields. So we find giant oil fields, and they have production for a limited amount of time, very good production, and then they decline. And then we go and we find another giant oil field, and that's the history of the world right now. We go deeper, we go to more remote areas, we drill a mile or two through water, or set drill rigs in a mile or two or even deeper water now. This idea of shale oil and shale gas is a viable industry in the United States, and it is expanding in the United States and also in Canada. So we see it as a starting to be a mature industry in the United States, but it is at best a startup industry anywhere else in the world.
There's something amazing about this whole thing also is, you know, there's all this panic about fracking, and I've investigated it. I'm sure you have too. Most of it is really not relevant. It dealt with inadequately sealed drill casings and a bunch of other factors that really most of the players in it are super environmentally sensitive, and they don't take any chances whatsoever. And they go way beyond, especially you look in Pennsylvania, they're purifying that water and it's not getting dumped. It's getting reused in these wells. So, but if there were proper incentives in place, meaning tax incentives, like let's say you didn't pay any taxes or reduced tax rate on any well that got drilled and you didn't pay the taxes for 5 years, we would be energy self-sufficient in a record short period of time. I'm convinced of it.
Well, I would not disagree with that. We could also have been energy sufficient for the last 40 years if we've been able to drill offshore, but we can't cry over spilt milk. We've got to deal with the hand we've been dealt, and as good poker players, we should be able to do that, and hopefully at some point you got an ace in the hole. But the real answer for the problems in natural gas in the United States are infrastructure build out. We found too much gas. Obama has called for increased natural gas drilling, but that ain't going to happen with $2 gas. And right. until we get the ability to do some infrastructure build out, the gas market looks horrible. That said, the real future of natural gas is in LNG, liquefied natural gas, because it will remove the landlocked nature of this. But right now we have no compression plants in the United States, or let me put it this way, in the continental United States. We have a small one in Alaska that's right. existed for 40 plus years. But the idea right now is with these big ships, the floating LNG compression plants, and to me that looks like the future, where you don't put plants in a physical land-based plant, but you've got them parked offshore and you're compressing the gas right there and taking it with these tankers wherever it's needed. So perhaps that's the idea that will succeed in the near future here.
Yeah, I think you're right. It makes a lot of sense, because then you just bring the infrastructure in and pump it out, but you got to have the pipelines, obviously, to get it to where it needs to be. And it's going to be interesting to see. But yeah, energy self-sufficiency, no matter what the government does to try to stop it, and the poor policies that it adopts towards oil exploration and gas exploration, they can't stop it, because this is the free market, private capital working its magic. You know, there's nothing, the government has had so many bad policies towards energy, like for instance oxygenated gasoline in areas with high pollution, and I forget about it every year until this week. My car, I was getting about 22 to 23 miles to the gallon, and it went up to 27 to 28, and I said, how did that happen? And then it dawned on me, oxygenation, because that cuts your mileage by 15 to 20%. That's just a typical example, and it hasn't done anything to decrease air pollution that anybody has proven yet anyway, right?
Now that's true, and what it's really done is it's made the world hungrier, because we're basically turning food into fuel, and but that's the farm lobby of the Midwestern U.S. responsible for that. So what do you do?
Yeah. Did they get rid of the ethanol subsidy last year? It expired, but I don't know if it got renewed, and I haven't seen it anywhere. Do you know off the
time? To my knowledge, and I'm speaking off the cuff here, it was changed, but it did get renewed, basically pushed through by some senators in the Corn Belt of Iowa and Illinois, to my knowledge. So it's changed somewhat, but there is still a substantial subsidy for growing corn and turning it into ethanol.
Yeah, absurd thing. It just uses more energy than it produces. It causes food riots around the world, causing corn prices to go way up, and political global uncertainty. Just terrible program, proven to really hurt people, and yet that's what government does. So I don't want to get started on you with this one, Mickey, but we both know the score here. But where do we find you again, Mickey?
I can be found at mercenarygeologist.com and mercenarygeologist.asia, and also permeating the airwaves. And I thank you very much for giving me the opportunity once again, Kerry.
All right, Mickey. Hey, we'll talk to you again soon. A couple weeks, we'll be doing our monthly wrap-up.
That's always fun. I look forward to it, Kerry.